Hello, I'm Peter Martin from The Economy Stupid. It's your guide to the world of business, buying and decision making, and what it means for your mortgage, your job, your rent, and what you can afford. Because the economy isn't just out there, it's in here. It's in what we do. Search for The Economy Stupid and hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
From Wurundjeri Country, I'm Luke Sidham-Dunton, and today on The Breakfast Wrap.
This is a landmark day for the environment in this country. It is also a good day for business in this country by providing more certainty, reducing delays, and making sure that we get better outcomes and improved productivity.
On the last parliamentary sitting day for the year, Labor has struck a deal with the Greens to overhaul the country's outdated environmental protection laws. We'll get the latest analysis from Melissa Clark. Then we'll head overseas to hear just what's happening in Hong Kong, where dozens of people have died in an apartment block fire.
Of course I'm not feeling good, seeing so many blocks on fire. How could anyone feel okay? Even though our block's fire seems being put out, seeing the fires all around still makes you feel terrible.
A scary night for Hong Kongers. We'll speak to a reporter standing out front of that ferocious blaze in the city. From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. Well, the news hasn't gotten any quieter towards the end of the week. Plenty of breaking news right across this morning's Radio National Breakfast program. It is the very last sitting day for federal parliament this year, and Labor have certainly cut it fine. The government snagging a deal with the Greens to overhaul the nation's environment laws, which will pass the Senate today. By the time you're listening to this, they may already have done. So to bring you up to speed, our political correspondent, Melissa Clark, broke the news on air and got through some of the detail of what this all means.
The deal with the Greens has been made after several weeks of Labor dancing with both the Coalition and the Greens. But ultimately, they have struck a deal with the Greens that does include some changes the business community has asked for. The Environment Minister, Murray Watt, has stood up with the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, this morning to announce that the deal has been struck. And he says the outcome is faithful to the Samuel Review that has been the guiding light for these reforms over the last 5 years.
Today is a landmark day for Australia's natural environment. Today, Labor's historic reforms to our national environmental laws will be passed with the support of the Greens in the Senate. These reforms will deliver a modern, fit-for-purpose set of national environmental laws for Australia for a long time to come.
Now, Anthony Albanese said that the deal was done, including with a meeting late last night with Larissa Waters, the Greens leader. He says he offered to meet with Susan Lee as well to see if a coalition deal was possible, but that Susan Lee didn't want to take up that meeting. He was very critical of the coalition's approach to negotiating this.
The problem that we had with the coalition was that their final letters had in it, and there are other things to come. Now, Parliament stops today. You can't, the day before, Parliament say, oh, well, we've got some other things, but we can't tell you what they are yet.
So, Mel, that's the deals being done. What will the nation's environment laws look under this deal? How will they look?
Yeah, we've definitely been stuck in the weeds of negotiating, but just to give the big picture here, what we will have now under this arrangement is a new process of having national environmental standards against which assessments for development are measured against. That is a very fundamental change to how development approvals will be assessed. We'll also have a National Environmental Protection Agency that has much more significant role of enforcement of these processes, including bigger penalties and stop work powers where things aren't being, where developments aren't abiding by the conditions of their development. It removes, ultimately, when it is all implemented, will remove the double up of approvals between state and federal government. So instead of having two processes, there will be one consistent process. And as key parts of this negotiating, the exemptions that were previously in place for land clearing and native forest logging will be phased out. Now, in these negotiations, there's been some extra concessions. There's going to be a support package for the forestry industry to allow it to invest in, grow in plantation forestry. The water trigger, which is something that sees coal and gas developments in certain circumstances have to undergo environmental approval, that stays with the federal government, a key push from the Greens there. But to be clear, as much as the deal has been struck with the Greens, the government has nonetheless made concessions for the business sector, such as improving definitions, limiting stop work orders and other measures in an effort to try and give it broad support across the various stakeholders here.
What's the politics of all of this? There wasn't a lot of love between the Greens and the government in the previous parliament, Mel. What does this tell us about the dynamics and the dynamics between the government and the opposition right now?
Yeah, it's quite interesting. This has really been a litmus test for how the different parties are approaching politics following the May election. Now, the Greens have drawn on plenty of experience and unity in their party room to undertake serious negotiations here. They've had an electoral imperative to be seen to be making progress, to be able to improve things. So the Greens getting a deal here is a win for them. And the key issues that they have campaigned on, native forest logging and various concessions for coal and gas, while it's not as strong as they want, they have extracted something on those grounds. This is undoubtedly a win for the Greens. For the coalition, they've really struggled to clarify their priorities and their red lines. And I think you've seen their internal division following the election play out as part of this process. For the government, they just wanted a deal done, and they wanted a deal done early in the electoral cycle so that this issue wasn't at the forefront of minds when voters next go to the polls. They needed to deliver what they promised their supporter base that they would do, which is overhaul these laws. They don't love doing deals with the Greens, as you pointed to, Sally, but in making a concession to the Greens at this point early in electoral cycle is less of a concern for Labor than if this had dragged on longer.
And that is our political correspondent, Melissa Clark, bringing you up to speed on those environmental laws that will be passing Parliament today on the last parliamentary sitting day for the year. Well, there are a few breaking stories this morning, which will continue to be updated right across the news today. The other was overseas in Hong Kong, this ferocious fire that's ripped through a residential tower block, killing dozens of people. The really worrying news is that as we're recording this on Thursday morning, there are still hundreds more people unaccounted for. At this stage, police have arrested three people on suspicion of manslaughter, and there are plenty of questions being raised around potential materials that could have made it easier for the fire to spread, like the bamboo scaffolding that's lining the building. It's a really fire-prone material, and it's still widely used throughout construction sites in Hong Kong. We were able to track down a reporter, a Hong Kong local, Ryan Chang, who was at the front of these burning buildings, and he gave us a sense of just what was unfolding.
Fire has subsided quite a great deal compared to what it was in the afternoon and at night as well, earlier in the night. We can still see that there are several fire ladders up and also firemen still hosing the buildings from above, and also some torchlight on several floors of the buildings themselves. So a sign that the firefighters are making their way through some of the floors.
Ryan, what's the reaction been to this fire in Hong Kong? Because so many Hong Kongers are living in these high-rise residential towers. It's one of the fears of living in that sort of accommodation. How have people been reacting?
Yes, well, people have been reacting in shock to the scale of this fire as well. And also questions are brewing on the use of materials outside the scaffolding, the tarpaulin that's been covering some of these buildings. And also people are wondering how on earth this happened so quickly. And also, so in response to many of the calls that you know, that over 900 people have been placed in community halls for temporary shelter. There have been calls online for people to deliver supplies, water, food, blankets, just to make sure that they're comfortable and know that they have the moral support of other people behind them.
What are the building standards like in Hong Kong? They're brand new buildings and some that have been there for many, many decades. How are things with regulations with fire when it comes to escapes, sprinkler systems, alarms, and the materials that have been used?
Well, the renovation outside our Wan Fuk Estate has started in the summer of last year. And, you know, the through media reports, they've the contractor that is in charge of the renovation has said that they have used materials that are up to standard out for their renovations works. However, the government has said that there will be a police investigation into that, and also a criminal probe into some of the materials used and whether or not they have been up to a government standard. The buildings themselves have been occupied since the 1980s. And in itself, so quite definitely, you know, there's been 40 years almost of between when they were occupied and when this fire happened. And of course, fire safety standards have improved quite a bit since then, with some large fires. The biggest one last time was in the mid-90s that had killed 40 people in Kowloon side. And so, you know, our authorities have constantly renewed their fire safety regulations.
This area of Hong Kong, Tai Po, I'm just looking at on Google Maps as we're talking. So there's quite a number of almost identical towers next to each other in this area. And this is sort of north of the main city of Hong Kong and Kowloon by the looks of it.
Yes, it's a major conurbation. And also there are surrounding this area as well. There are other residential towers, and yes, it's quite a heavily populated area north in the northern side of Kowloon.
It sounds like Hong Kong
new territories. Sorry,
it sounds like Ryan that Hong Kongers are really shocked by what's been unfolding overnight.
Yes, and also the scale of it is also quite unimaginable. I think unfathomable for a lot of Hong Kongers as well to have hundreds of people still missing. I think that's, we've really, fire standards, fire safety standards in Hong Kong are very high. And also this sort of a catastrophe has really rarely happened in many, many years in living memory.
And you were just listening to Hong Kong reporter Ryan Chang speaking to Radio National Breakfast from out the front of those burning towers. The good news that firefighters have been able to get those blazes under control, but the worrying news that the death toll is expected to keep climbing. Well, back home, and Optus customers have now dealt with their third outage in just a few short months. Crews yesterday spent hours trying to restore mobile phone service for more than 14,000 customers. The telco says vandals attempting to steal copper had cut several fibre cables in Melbourne's southeast. Now, you'll remember back in September, two deaths were linked to a mass outage, sparking inquiries by the regulator and the Senate. Alan Fells is the former chair of the Consumer Watchdog, the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, also known as the ACCC, and he came on with Sally to share his take.
It's happening too much. So I don't regard yesterday as kind of a one-off accident. The Optus tends to blame technical failures and external factors for all these outages. I think a better explanation is a failing culture, a faulty culture, a kind of lack of commitment to spending the extra dollars on total safety and reliability for customers.
Are they out of step with the other telcos in your view, or is this an industry-wide problem?
Yes, they seem to be so.
Since the deadly outage in September, there have been several outages which have affected 000 calls. You say that the federal government now needs to review its contracts with Optus. Why do you have that view?
We need a culture change and a real lesson to be taught, an incentive given to Optus to bring its safety practices into line And particularly because there are real safety questions for people when the emergency 000 service fails, stronger medicine is needed.
Alan, what sort of contracts are we talking about?
Well, there are all sorts of contracts Optus has with government, and also they have a number of spectrum license allocation issues coming up. What has happened at the moment, and this applies to all telco companies, is that the three big ones have got access to the spectrum, which is an extremely valuable thing to have. They are coming up for renewal and they should be put up to auction. But it sounds like this is not happening. It sounds like the regulator is, for some reason, been persuaded that that's not necessary. Typically, these spectrum auctions raise a lot of money for the public. They're good for competition because they bring in new competitors and put a bit of pressure on the current operators to do their best.
You're talking about new competitors. Is there a viable alternative given how relatively small our telecommunications market is here in Australia?
Well, the best answer to that will be to put it to a market test and see.
There were no reported impacts to 000 calls with this latest outage, but Shadow Communications Minister Melissa McIntosh says the government needs to urgently review the 000 system. What needs to happen, do you think?
Well, I do think we need a deeper investigation of what happened yesterday. Maybe it was just sabotage. Maybe they did everything. But I'm just not entirely satisfied to take Optus's comments at face value, given that in the past some of their initial PR-type comments have not proved to be true. But greater emphasis could be put on backup when 000 calls from someone fail and automatic rerouting mandated by law. Yes, I think the backup arrangements could be more strongly supported by law.
On Radio National Breakfast, you're hearing from Professor Alan Fells, a former chair of the ACCC. We're talking about Optus outages. The Australian Communications and Media Authority says it's seeking further information from Optus on the circumstances of the latest outage. It's also investigating what happened in September. What do you make of the response from the regulators so far?
Well, I would prefer them to go in a bit harder. Their track record is not one of being an overactive regulator on telco and maybe on other fronts. So I certainly welcome them looking into all of this. Some of the emphasis on inquiries, including the Optus commissioned inquiry, is seemingly on what specific technical failures there were, whereas, as I've said, I think there are broader cultural issues in Optus's approach. I think Singapore seems to have been very focused on getting cost-cutting in Australia at any cost to safety.
Alan Fells there, the former chair of the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission. Well, we're going to end the breakfast wrap today in the Apple Isle because Tasmania's fiscal future is back in the spotlight after the state's credit rating dropped to the lowest in the country, right alongside the Northern Territory. Moody's Ratings has downgraded Tasmania from AA2 to AA3. It's flagging a sharp rise in the state's debt and its interest burdens. Now, the announcement comes ahead of a parliamentary vote on the controversial Macquarie Point Stadium, which now has a price tag of over $1 billion. Erica Betts is the Treasurer of Tasmania, and here's what Sally asked him first.
Tasmania is now one of the riskiest jurisdictions in Australia to lend to. How damaging is that for investment in the state, in your view?
Not at all damaging for investment in the state. Business confidence is high. All the reports are telling us that. The unemployment rate is historically low. We've got the lowest in the nation. So things are going well on other fronts. The credit rating clearly is something that we need to deal with. And might I add that the A3 rating is what France has, Taiwan, and it's within OECD parameters. So is it good news? No, it's not. But it's not something over which we need to be too alarmed.
Net direct and indirect debt has doubled from about 66% of operating revenue in Tasmania in June 2019 to more than 130% in June 2025. Moody's has said without countermeasures, Tasmania's debt could rise to 180% by 2029. What immediate levers are you going to pull to reverse that trajectory?
In the interim budget, which was delivered earlier this month, I outlined the foundations, but indicating that the May budget would be the one where a lot of the heavy lifting would be undertaken. And we've already indicated our view that the public service needs to be right-sized. And it's interesting that shortly thereafter, the Federal Labor government has been talking a similar language of the need to right-size their public service. We need to make some of the decisions that gets us back basically to the pre-COVID era. We allowed our public service to grow in circumstances of a national emergency, and that now needs to be reined back in.
The independent economist Sol Eslake has said that revenue raising in Tasmania through new taxes and increased levies could be necessary to reverse debt. Are you prepared to reconsider those options?
Look, you never say never in public life, I suppose, but as a Liberal, my instinct is not to increase taxes or have new taxes, but I'm not going to preempt what will be said in May. The most important thing for us as a state government is to rein in the expenditure rather than increase the impost on our fellow Tasmanians. Might I also say that our financial situation would be so much better if the Canberra people were to abide by their agreement in relation to health. We were made promises in 2023 for federal health funding, and at the moment, as we speak, we have about 100 people in our hospitals ready for discharge into age or disability care, but there aren't any places for them. As a result, we have to fund those positions whilst they remain in our hospitals. So there's a lot of pressure on our budget. Canberra could be of great assistance just by living up to what I think are reasonable
expectations. But this is primarily, it's the Tasmanian government and governments that have got Tasmania into the majority of this strife. Is that fair to say?
Look,
because on health, you're dealing with the same challenge as other states are when it comes to that federal funding issue right now. Yeah.
Yes, and look, can I say to you quite clearly, I'd prefer to be the Tasmanian Premier than the Victorian Premier, given the challenges that they face. So,
Treasurer or Premier? Have you just announced something, Eric Abetz?
I'm not sure what I just said, but I meant
Premier.
Treasurer. My apologies. I would prefer to be the Treasurer of Tasmania rather than the Treasurer of Victoria. Or indeed, for that matter, I would prefer to be the Treasurer of Tasmania rather than the Premier of Victoria, just to make it absolutely clear. But look, the situation in the states is difficult in relation to health agreements, and the Canberra government needs to step up to that.
Eric Abetz there, the Treasurer of Tasmania, certainly not the Premier, speaking to Sally Sarah on Radio National Breakfast. And that is it for the Breakfast Wrap for today. Thank you very much for listening. Every interview you heard was presented by Sally Sarah and produced by the ABC Radio National Breakfast team. I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon, and we'll be back tomorrow with the last Breakfast Wrap for the week. See you then.